This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums, and with me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Christopher Spencer, the owner and publisher of the website OzarksUnbound.com, for another weekly edition of the weekly session we call Unlicensed Opinion. Christopher, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Top of the morning.
That's right. And with us on the phone from Washington, D.C., it's Brock Thompson. Brock, a native Arkansan, is the author of the new book, The Unnatural State, Arkansas and the Queer South. It offers something of a historical rarity, an examination of gay life, politics, and culture in the state. From so-called womanless weddings staged as entertainment in the first half of the last century, to battles over sodomy laws, to the role of Eureka Springs as a gay-friendly community, the book studies a sometimes hidden, often controversial history of Arkansas. Brock Thompson will discuss his book and sign copies at Nightbird Books on Dixon Street in downtown Fayetteville on Thursday, November 18th, beginning at 7. Brock Thompson, thanks for joining us.
Hello, Carl. Hello, Christopher. Thank you for having me.
I want to ask you first about a word that is in the second part of the title of the book, and that is queer. You explain in the introduction why you chose that word, but I'd like to hear you tell the rest of us, why queer?
That's a really great question, and I've one that I often get. But I think queer is a very interesting word, very useful word to use in this study, in that, first of all, I came across a lot of identities that would not conform to just simply gay or lesbian. A lot of people that would not agree that that was what they should be called or what they would identify as. So queer would often be useful in that.
Brock, when I came across the word queer and noticed a few of the different ways it was used, it almost came to resonate with the word other to an extent. I'm thinking of, in particular, a passage about the lesbian separatists, actually, mm-hmm. in the Ozarks, and where they kind of found some allies among the hill folk of the Ozarks. At least they weren't openly antagonized, because there was also sort of a queerness, a strangeness that those Arkansas hillbillies had also felt.
Well, sure. I mean, one only needs to look to the film Deliverance to see how hillbillies are often queered. Any sort of other outside the heteronormative norm, as it were, or people are often queered. We see that, I think, in the Rockefeller section as far as black men during the civil rights era, where the quickest way to discredit a civil rights leader was to question their sexuality. I think Martin Luther King went through that. Martin Luther King Jr. went through that quite a few times. So any sort of person outside the heteronormative mainstream could often be queered, and that certainly wasn't just gays and lesbians, as you pointed out.
Did you, I think I heard you just reference the 1966 race between Justice Jim Johnson and Winthrop Rockefeller?
That's right, yes.
that was a race, if I understand correctly from your book, that that term or that a suspicion upon Rockefeller's sexuality was certainly cast.
Absolutely.
Can you tell me just a little bit about how nasty that race got?
That race got particularly nasty, and it's interesting to note, of course, that was the first time Arkansans were going to elect a Republican as governor, first time since Reconstruction. So it was hotly contested. It was after the long battle over segregation there at Civil Rights, Central High, excuse me, and it got very nasty with Justin Shim Johnson, who was already one of the more nastier figures Arkansas politics had produced, but Johnson was just throwing everything but the kitchen sink at Rockefeller, and that included a lot of sexual innuendo, rumors about alcoholism, rumors about his sexuality, rumors that he was having this homosexual affair with one of his trusted aides, who was also a black man, so you consider that was sort of almost a double taboo in Arkansas, as it were, as far as mixing sexuality and homosexuality, and then on top of that is sort of a miscegenation, as it were.
And what was the avenue through which these very nasty little campaign messages came out? Was it just word of mouth between people?
Word of mouth. He would spread these rumors. He would often come up with these dubious publications. One was called Republicans for a Better Government. There was numerous publications. He had his own newsletter, I think it was called the White Citizens Journal or something like that, that he would distribute throughout the state. So he managed to get the word out pretty well.
The first part of the book, you detail these forms of rural entertainment that took place, especially in the first half of the 20th century, womanless weddings that were sometimes put on to raise money. this is a part of rural entertainment that I was kind of unfamiliar with. Tell me a little bit about this.
Oh, these Womanless Weddings productions were just phenomenal, and apparently they were quite popular before World War II or before civil rights. Basically a drag show, as it were, where one man would dress up as the bride and get married essentially to another man. And this sort of folk production, a folk play, meant as rural entertainment, fundraisers, just a farcical comedy on the wedding ceremony, and very quite popular. The first one that I discovered there was at one of the Japanese American relocation centers, or concentration camps, or internment camps, or however you wanted to define them, in southeast Arkansas, where the guards essentially would dress up and drag and perform these plays for the internees there. And
there were no real, I mean, this was just accepted through the first half of the 20th century, I mean, as entertainment, and then it slowly sort of fades away, doesn't it?
It does fade away when that sort of thing, when drag essentially becomes more and more recognized as a form of gay community self-expression. You can see the rural womanless weddings and the rural folk drag productions just sort of waning in popularity as gay and lesbian sort of take on the drag culture in Arkansas.
A poignant historical figure that you write about in the book, poignant in his childhood and then later in adulthood, is Robert Howard. You first write about him when he's trying to run away from home, don't you?
That's right. He sort of introduces the Diamond State section there. And talking about drag culture, he did try to run away from home once, dressed as a little girl. He was about 10 years old at the time, I think.
And actually was kind of successful at running away. He got picked up by a family who took him to New Orleans for a little while.
That's right. He made it all the way to New Orleans and then back to Arkansas dressed as a little girl. I'm not sure, and he doesn't know either when I spoke to him last, whether the family knew that he was actually a little boy or whether they didn't care, but or whether it didn't matter or whatnot. So
I found that particular story so symbolic of what many people who happen to be gay or transgendered must feel. That you want to run away if you were in a small Arkansas town that didn't accept you, but then you become homesick, and
Absolutely.
You want to come back.
Right. And that's a message that I found out largely throughout the book, and many of the themes, that we have this sort of notion of some sort of gay or queer migration from the rural to the urban, as gays and lesbians are just simply assumed that once they come out of the closet, they must hightail it to an urban center, New York or San Francisco or Washington, D.C., Chicago. That's simply not the case. Well, I found that Arkansas had many diverse and wonderful gay and lesbian communities and still does, that gay and lesbian identity is not solely attached to an urban identity.
Well, and Brock, in, I guess, doing your academic research on this project, there was also a personal note. You mentioned your Aunt Opal.
That's right, yeah.
During the book, which I found, I mean, I thought it was kind of a refreshing touch to have that personal connection there. And you yourself are gay, right?
That's correct, yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about writing from that perspective, but yet also being a scholar of all the material, and how that all works together?
Well, that's a great question. This clearly is not your mother's history book, not only because of the subject matter, but because I also do write from the first person. I can remember early drafts of this when I use I as in referring to myself. Some scholars just totally balked at that, saying, oh, that's not appropriate. And I would sort of challenge that notion, saying, well, why not? Why can't the author or the historian communicate to the audience of why this work is important to them on a personal level? And I think that, too, helps the reader then connect to the material on a different level or a deeper level. I think I just wanted to sort of usher this story along from a first-person narration just to express why it is important to me and why I'm writing it, in hopes that the reader then will discover more about the text and maybe about their own identity.
Do you mind just quickly telling the readers who Aunt Opal was?
Oh, that's a great question. When I came out to my parents, I guess I was 18, I was a freshman at Hendricks College, and my dad later revealed to me that his aunt, or my great aunt, Opal, was probably most likely a lesbian. She had died by that point. And I have a few memories of her from my childhood, but I was just really enthralled by that and really interested in her. And she had lived with another woman for most of her life. But it was a time in Arkansas when sort of men and women could sort of get around these identities, gay and lesbian identities, operating under terms like bachelor or old maids or spinsters, or they never found the right woman or they never found the right man, sort of identities that allowed people to sort of live in the margins but still be somewhat accepted by the larger society.
Because so many people did live in the margins or did live outside the realm of being able to publicly self-identify, did that make research and finding history for the unnatural state difficult?
It did at the beginning, but then once you sort of realize what terms and identities people operated under or what terms you had to look, that sort of helped. I had to sort of assemble my own roadmap, as it were, in coming up with an Arkansas gay and lesbian history, Arkansas queer history. I would go to many archives, which were so helpful throughout the state. But if I went in there and said, I would like to talk to you about what you might have as far as drag history, they would, of course, turn me away. But if I went and said, I'm looking for womanless weddings or womanless beauty pageants or blackface minstrelsy, then, of course, they would have a great many or a great deal to offer me. But you just had to understand or know how to go about asking for these things.
There's also space devoted in the book to Arkansas struggling legally with sodomy laws, and you have a chapter that opens brilliantly with a letter written to then Governor David Pryors. He's wrestling with whether to sign a bill into law.
That's correct. That bill landed on his desk there. I believe it was 1977. He was governor at the time. Arkansas has a sort of a strange history with the sodomy law, and I speak about this in the book. And then the first incarnation of the sodomy law actually made it illegal for a black man to have sex with a white woman. That was Arkansas's definition of sodomy.
Vice versa?
Yeah. Well, no, not just the black.
Just that one direction, huh?
Yeah, just that one direction, as it were. Later, that sodomy was rewritten and redefined to include everyone, male, female, had made no separation of the sexes or genders or homosexual versus heterosexual. And then even later still, it was narrowed to include just simply gay and lesbian, or gay men, especially.
So when you're done reading, when you're done writing this book, what do you think Arkansas, can the state take pride, shame in its treatment of gay, transgendered, and queer people over the decades?
Well, I think it's a bittersweet history. First of all, I wanted Arkansans to know that actually they did indeed, first of all, have a gay and lesbian history. That's one thing that I think the book should be able to answer. And that history wasn't all that bad, and that's part of the historical timeline. I think we have to be able to look back in this book and say, actually, Arkansans and Arkansas as a state actually encouraged and fostered a gay and lesbian community or a queer community. It was only later when, after the Civil Rights Movement or the 70s or during the AIDS crisis in the 80s, where Arkansas began to treat its gay and lesbian population with a great deal of malice. And I think it's slowly coming out of that phase.
Well, actually, a question about some recent history.
Mm-hmm.
You may have heard the name Clint McCants.
Yes.
Vice president of the school district over at Pleasant Plains.
He recently is he former vice president now?
Former, yes. Yeah. He recently resigned.
Yes.
After making some comments on Facebook, which essentially said that he would prefer to wear purple if the gay people of, I guess, Arkansas killed themselves. That was essentially, I mean, that's sort of what it said. I guess the reason I bring that up is because you grew up in what community in Arkansas?
Conway.
You were not out at that time, but did you face any sort of prejudice yourself in the schools?
I faced a little bit of bullying and marginalization, but being white and middle class, I think, allowed me to sort of sail through without much criticism. But there were other kids that fared far worse than I did. But I made it through. And
it gets better?
And it does get better. Thank you. Yes. Thank you for including that. That's an important message. And I think, to answer your question sort of on another level, I think this book, I hope this book, illustrates for many why it's important for minority groups, especially gays and lesbians, to have a sense of their own history and how empowering that tool can be to have a sense of where you come from, your roots, know that you actually have a very proud and very colorful history.
The name of the book is The Unnatural State, Arkansas and the Queer South by Brock Thompson. Brock will be signing copies and discussing the book at Nightbird Books on November 18th. That begins at 7 o'clock, Nightbird on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. Brock, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, guys, for having me.
And we're back. It's time now for the second part of our weekly conversations. We call this plug or predict. And
yes,
simply, we either plug or predict.
That's what we do. We choose something that either we prognosticate will happen within the near future, or we mention to the lovely listeners out there something that we feel like is worth checking out, or at least Googling.
Yes. I went first last week, so you're up first.
Okay. Well, Kyle, you've heard of maybe ALT, the Artist Laboratory Theater.
Spent some time with them a few months ago doing a story, yes.
Cool deal. Yeah, they're fairly, I think they're actually our newest theater troupe in town. And I know they're trying to raise money to go to the New Orleans Fringe Festival and are putting on an encore performance of Bombs, Babes, and Bingo. That's Friday, November 12th, 8 to 11 at the Whole Earth Organic Lounge down here in downtown Fayetteville. And should be a really good show. It had good word of mouth from the first show. So,
and it's interesting theater. It's because there is not a prescribed linear script here. All the same things happen every performance, but the incidents happen in different order based on chance.
Yeah, I think the scenes are put together in different orders.
Right, because by random chance, that's where the bingo comes in. You pick out a ball in that scene. And so, one, it's kind of a different way to see theater. And two, it's an interesting way for people who create theater to see if a certain scene can still have emotional resonance in a different way, in a different place.
If that conflict actually comes in the beginning, you get an in media res
type
sensation.
And then you can reflect on that the rest of the way, and I think it helps writers and actors figure out the meat of the script. And eventually this play, I don't know, might have a linear structure. I don't know.
I like the whole experimental nature.
I do too.
I think we should have more experimental theater.
Well, it's research too,
yeah.
I think, for the people involved both as patrons and as participants. Okay, so that's Friday night at the Whole Earth Organic Lounge, which is just off the square in Fayetteville.
Absolutely.
Now, my
tickets are $15.
Oh, very good.
And now, please.
Yes, I'm going to do a plug as well. It's also Friday, November 12th, but it doesn't conflict because it's a morning event.
Fantastic.
It is the first official game of the Razorback women's basketball season. Now, for the past, six of the past 8 years or something like that, I did the radio play-by-play. I'm not doing that anymore because I've got so much on my plate here. But the first game of the season this year is a Friday 11:30 a.m. game. Now, a lot of elementary students will be there. It's kind of a field trip. It should be a raucous atmosphere. Arkansas will host Florida A&M Friday morning beginning 11:30 at Bud Walton Arena. Until next Monday then, Christopher, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And people can always go to OzarksUnbound.com.
They can anytime they want to.
That's right. It's open 24 hours a day. Thanks, Christopher.
Bye-bye.